Our conversation continues as ThinkGen CEO Noah Pines, Audrey Wu, and special guest Jamie Haddock take a deeper dive into the key learnings from the Habit Lens projects.
Hello, and welcome to the Pharma Think Pod. We're ThinkGen. We provide customized marketing research and brand strategy solutions for healthcare companies. We're known for delivering insights that generate results. How? We know the science behind the research, we ask the right questions, and we find and report the relevant insights. In this podcast, we highlight what our clients are thinking about and our thoughts on their thoughts. We know how important it is to focus on what's important, and what's important right now is habits. So let's dive in.
Yeah. Can I just add a quick point that I thought about during our presentation but didn't have a good way to organically fit it in? But you know, something I've learned along this process is sort of the importance of that sustaining, you know, the habit. You know, if you disrupt something once, great. But if you aren't able to do it again, the impact is going to be minimal. And since I work in oncology, I think the majority of drugs tend to not make people feel great. And there's already a layer of negative reinforcement if you're waiting for, you know, cancer to respond or a lab value to respond. But in the meantime, you've got a patient being, oh, this is making me so tired, or this is making me so nauseous or whatever. The first thing the doctor is hearing is so negative. It's not, you know, there are some you know, chronic illnesses where you're actually alleviating a symptom, which is great. But I think in oncology, you've got this extra hurdle that these things often make you feel worse before you get better.
Yeah, and that's something that when we do specific habit lens focused studies, we hear a lot about that from patients, from their care partners, as well as from physicians. And you know, what can we do then to help make that reality more palatable. There's something else I was going to ask you about, Jamie.
Sure.
You had a lot of strong feelings about this from one of our audience members about a concern about being too niched in, do you remember that?
Yeah, this is I get it. People aren't out there supporting and launching drugs and really aiming to get 5% of the market in some niche patient population. That's not, I think, what people step in to do. But I think those are two separate problems. I think the first problem is you're not used. And if you're used, then you're niched. And then I think it's a separate problem than I'm in a niche and I want broader use. I think those need to be addressed as two different issues. Not that you're going to compel a non-user to become a user in the exact same way you're going to compel a niche user to become a broad user. So I think it's important to understand, I guess, the material impact, like what is the better target in terms of the impact you can have, you know. Is converting non-users to niche users actually going to be the better strategy? That's going to depend on anyone's situation. But I think at the end of the day, I've always championed that like niche use is better than no use. And from niche use, you can start to understand what causes that niche use to try to expand use. So I would say don't let the threat of being used in a very small, specific population stop you from at least trying to convert people to become users in any capacity. Because at that point, you've created awareness, you've created a recognition, and you've created an experience with your drug that hopefully you can rely on to expand in the future to broaden your utilization.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important perspective. We had received a question from the audience just about, you know, this idea of having to start somewhere and a concern about, you know, what happens if you become, you know, entrenched in a niche. And of course, I mean, that's something that, again, has to be thoughtfully considered, and why we would also counsel, do your habit landscaping examination, do the habit mapping as early as possible. We made the point, Jamie, last week, that ideally, and you reiterate this, do this as early as possible before your medication has been commercialized. We do a lot of habit lens work for medications that have already been commercialized. Hindsight is 20/20. A habit lens helps us put a much finer point on opportunities for improvement. But ideally, you would not need to fix something that you would have seen so clearly if you had identified the habit lens at the same time as your customer buying process work, at the same time that you did your patient journey work, all of the foundational research studies, you know, the market structure work that you would do, you know, when you're preparing your medication for launch, right? 18 months, 24 months before your anticipated approval date as part of your launch readiness plan. That is the time to be doing the habit mapping. Don't wait, right? Don't wait until your medication is floundering or you're not going to make your number and you're under pressure to do the habit mapping. Because we'll be able to help you see, you know, why your medication is you know, not meeting its objectives, but the time to do that, just avoid it at all if you could just do it early as part of the foundational research studies. So, yeah.
So if I could just cut in on 2 points I wanted to make. First of all, it's an amazing presentation. I appreciate it. Well spoken, well thought out, with obviously a lot of practical implications. You know, Jamie, you talked about the fact that in oncology, oftentimes, you know, the first experience that a patient has upon being administered a dose of a medication oftentimes is a negative experience, whether it's some, you know, side effect like fatigue or nausea or something like that. And that is sort of characteristic oftentimes of cancer. What I think is interesting, or what the opportunity that arises when I think about habit lens and our habit cycle and Audrey's insistence on the six node aspect to it, is that behavioral belief. Because I actually have a close loved one that went through CAR T therapy. And, you know, as you said, the first thing you experience is just almost debilitating fatigue. But the way that this person's oncologist framed it was, that means it's working. Was, you know, the more of the side effect you might feel initially, that is a good sign. And so in the same way that when we think about behavioral belief, one of the archetypal examples I offer is like no pain, no gain. You go to the gym, you work out, your muscles hurt, you know, you feel exhausted, but we interpret that in our minds as being good. It's being a good thing, a hard workout. And in the same way, if we can get, you know, doctors on board with giving that kind of a message back to patients, like, okay, you're not feeling well, that's a good sign. And that sort of being a form of reinforcing feedback to them initially, that it's working. So I thought that was a great point that you made, and something we see a lot, but potentially an opportunity to help fuel the habit, both on the part of the doctor, but also that the patient would then come in for, you know, their next dose, that they would want to do it again because they feel like it's working.
Right. Yeah.
The other thing, and this is, I guess, more of a question I put out there as a question, almost a rhetorical question, because this is oftentimes a question that we get after we do habit lens presentations are, so great, you know, you've convinced me that it's important to study habits. It's important to study habits early, but how do you discern that a particular behavior is habitual? How do you somehow get a doctor to acknowledge that her or his behavior is kind of a, if you will, as Audrey used the word, default type of behavior, when they're not necessarily going to admit that, or when they're telling you that every I make a decision individually, or my treatment decision making is individualized to the patient. You know, what are some ways, or what are some things potentially that we can look for and listen for as we're actually doing the research that signals, that's actually a very routine behavior. So I guess I wanted to, I have an answer in my mind, but I guess I just wanted to kind of get your perspectives on that.
Yeah, and this is always a struggle, is that gap between, what they say and then what they do. I see it a lot, if you just give a survey question, it's like, what is the treatment attributes that are most important to you? It's always what efficacy first, safety second, then third might be a variety of things depending on the area, but maybe that's access related things, convenience related things, what have you. But then you look at, what you do, some sort of correlation, and then those don't actually correlate to behavior. If they think your product's really good on efficacy and they say efficacy is number one, then they should be using that product, right? And that's not what happens. And I think that's probably, a good sign that there's something deeper here, that's a little more unstated. But I think when you posited this as a rhetorical question, I was like, oh no. And so I think that's why it's so hard. It's like, if we could crack that, maybe we wouldn't even be talking today if we had a good answer. But I think the qualitatively, you kind of can get to this by, something we did was, we had the doctor say, what do you do when you talk, when you talk to a patient, how does it go? And then you talk to a patient and it's like, when you talk to the doctor, how does it go? And you see the huge disconnects, you start to zoom in on reality. And there are different ways to, try to capture the reality as opposed to what people say they do versus what they actually do.
Yeah, no, I think, well said. I mean, I think definitely what you just described, and particularly when you can observe a disparity between stated behavior and actual behavior, that here's what I do, and then you see them actually interact with a patient. We've done some avatar research where we have them interacting as if they're doing an actual visit with a patient. You're like, well, that is very different from what they said they did, or they're focusing on different things than they said they would. So I think that too is helpful. I think the way that I like to think about the question is that it's about listening. I think it's about what you're listening for. And, for example, you brought up, Jamie, before, the question of cost. When I hear a doctor say, okay, I really like your drug, I have patients in mind for it, and then you get to that, but what's it going to cost? To me, to some extent, that's a signal that there's going to be a bigger issue than we actually think, their bigger barrier, because once we start talking about cost, then that becomes like, I'm scratching my head in my mind about the value of it to some degree. And that's also, I think, for a lot of doctors, I hate to say it, sort of a convenient excuse to say, well, I'm not using that product because of the cost of it. So I think that, to me, when they bring that up, when you show them a profile of a drug, that should be a big signal of, okay, we have a big mountain to climb here, because they're not necessarily maybe saying good things, but they may not necessarily see the value. Because I've had the opportunity over my career to work on some of the most amazing breakthroughs of the last three decades. And one of the things that I note is when you really show someone a breakthrough product, there's no mention of cost at all.
Yeah.
Zero. It's like, this is, next generation, or this is going to shift the paradigm, or this is going to lead to improved outcomes, better survival, better, better, you know, dramatically better quality of life, cure, you know, when those types of things come up, their doctor, you know, the cost doesn't come into play as much. But I think really doing this research well, in my experience, is a function not so much of the questioner, but the listening part of it, and then applying this framework that Audrey described earlier, you know, really kind of plugging the framework in.
Yeah, and I know we're being very, it's just an example to say cost, but cost is such a short word that means so many things. And if you don't quite understand what cost is, like, what part of cost are we talking about? Like, you're going to miss a big part of the picture. Is a patient out of pocket cost, cost to the system, cost to my office? It's important to really listen and really understand when someone says something, like, what do they truly mean by that?
Something else that I've learned, you know, as we've been working on habit studies, and I know that we used to talk about habit as unconscious drivers of behavior. And I feel like that set us up for expectations of a methodology where we put the participants into some state of hypnosis or something like that. And what I've come to learn, having moderated, you know, many of our habit-focused studies, is that these aren't necessarily unconscious behaviors. These are decisions that have already been made. That's how I think about it. Decisions that have already been made that have then become the default decision that has to be ruled out, not ruled in. And when you think about it that way, we can describe the decisions that we've already made day after day, i.e. our habits. And when I'm talking with physicians, there's questions we can ask that help them to describe to us, you know, whether this is a decision that has been made. Classically, what we do is just ask them, you know, it's more less of us talking, more of us listening, which is classic market research methodology anyway. And then as they're talking about their approach to a specific treatment area, we'll ask questions like, okay, this decision that you made, is it patellar reflex or is it a head scratcher? And they'll say patellar reflex, and they'll get it. They'll start to say, oh, that's my habit. This is why, you know, we ask them to think back to the first time they ever learned about, you know, the medication that is their default choice. And the stories they tell about those medications, you know, help us to understand why they are so anchored, you know, as part of their treatment armamentarium. And so I just wanted to encourage, like, we use the term habit because habit is something that is universally, I think, understood. We have thought about whether we should change habit to something different, because often we hear that habit has sort of this negative connotation, especially in our industry when we think about, you know, the tragedies associated with habit-forming medications, the opioid crisis. That's negative, habit in a negative sense. But, you know, so we asked ourselves a million times, should we rename this? But we settled on habit because that's language that so many of our clients and you know, other people who work in this area understand. But I think of it as the default decision, the decision that has already been made.
And I think for me, I mean, I had read Atomic Habits outside of the context of my work many years ago. But when you start talking about this, you see it in yourself all the time. And yeah, you're not kind of completely unconscious in doing certain things, but you've already made certain decisions because that's what works for you. And you need an extra, something extra to get you to stop doing it that way. And I think when you think about it in the context of your own life, it makes a little bit more sense. And that might be a good way to sell it to your own colleagues if you need the funding to do these sorts of studies.
I mean, it's as natural as a human instinct as one could think of. And you know, when we start, when we talk with other clients about this idea of habit, the first thing I think that we try to do is to get them to reflect upon how so much of what they do in a given day, how busy their lives are, similar to customers, similar to doctors, and how you rely so heavily on different habits to just do all of the routine, mundane types of things that just, you know, you have to do, you know, eat, communicate, how you travel, get, you know, get yourself from point A to point B is all extremely automatic and programmed in a way. So, yeah, I mean, Audrey, I think the point you made about this notion of looking for something unconscious and, you know, putting the respondent into sort of hypnosis, I think you don't necessarily have to do that. I think, you know, people definitely, if you ask them the right questions or listening to the right things, can acknowledge that certain behaviors are, for the most part, automatic and routine, and there isn't much in the way of deliberation. And when in fact you try to introduce deliberation, try, this is a good exercise, which is get into your car and start to apply like deliberate conscious effort to routine things like starting it up or putting it into gear. It's a little painful. I mean, I've done this with myself. I've been like, okay, let me start to think about the order of what I do, which is brake, turn the car on, get the garage door open, put it into reverse, or, you know, some manner of that, put my seatbelt on. You start to think about that, and your brain almost kicks back against you because your brain is like, we solved all these problems already. What are you doing? Why are you trying to short circuit the neurocircuitry, the tracks that have been laid down that solved all of these problems already? So it just goes to show, I mean, you can do these thought experiments yourself to realize just how hard it is to impact a habit, to bring it to a conscious level so that you might try to change it in some way.
Yeah, or how jarring it is when something is amiss in your normal, like my key fob wasn't close enough for my car to start, and then I just pushed the button and went immediately for the gear shifter, but the car wasn't on. So took a second to be like, what's going on?
Rental car, when you get a rental car and you're like, everything is out of place, like, where's the starter button? Where's the shift? Where's the radio? You know, the mirrors are all out of place. My seat is in the wrong position. Like, it is a jarring experience to be in a, and that is the driver's seat of a car is a context. And here you are presented with a host of new cues that are forcing your brain off of the tracks of circuitry that you're so used to. And you're right, it is kind of an out-of-body experience to be in that situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when we think about introducing our new treatments, you know, to physicians, we are in effect asking them to get in a new rental car and enjoy that experience. When you think about it that way, it's a really, really tough ask.
Yeah, especially if driving the rental car is like a horrible, you know, you, like it's not as fast as your car, it's not as comfortable as your car. Just to extend the metaphor even further.
And who hasn't had that experience, right? Where I'm just thinking, why is this car designed this way? This crazy thing.
Yeah, so you still have to overcome, you know, certain things, not just starting it.
Yes. All right. Well, anything else top of mind for you, Jamie, before you sign up? Any additional last words of wisdom for our listeners?
Yeah, I think, you know, habit understanding, and we just really just redefined what habit actually means, and I'm just going to go back to using the term for simplicity. But I think these are very important things to understand about your market and your therapeutic area and your drug, and really better contextualize the behaviors that you see and help you identify the behaviors that you would want to see as you start planning, your tactics as part of brand planning. And I think if we don't, take an objective look at this closely and do it well, you're going to miss a lot of things. And it's always harder to scramble and look and try to reverse something than it is to just start it and do it right from the beginning. So I also want to thank you for letting me be a guest on your podcast and a co-presenter at PMRC. This has been great. I don't think I've been on a podcast before, so.
You're our first guest on the Think Pod. It's such a milestone, and I can't thank you enough for just recognizing the value and the importance of applying a habit lens and being such a champion and an advocate for it. Thank you. I just look forward to continuing to work with you. And I think you're amazing.
Thank you so much for listening to the Think Pod. Be sure to follow us on SoundCloud, Spotify, and also check out our website, think-gen.com, to learn more about the habit lens.